To and Fro Upon the Earth, a novel. Part 1, To and Fro. Scene 1. "That's one small step for man," I said under my breath as I stepped out of the van and into the light of day. The other men climbed out behind me, but I paid no attention to them. Two buses sat idling in the broad parking lot like sleeping monsters, gently snoring. The sign on the front of the closest read San Bernardino, Los Angeles Union. The other was Phoenix, Tucson. Beside the two buses, there were three cars, parked apart across the asphalt expanse like vehicle outcasts, afraid to get too close to anyone else. I took a deep breath of the warm morning air. My plan had been to return home, despite how different it would be. Many of my contacts would still be there, still alive, but that other emptiness might be more than I could stand. I heard a female squealing. One of the men was hugging and kissing her. She was not attractive and looked far older than him, though her bawling sounded like a child. The man was delighted. They stopped kissing and began to talk with animation. I watched as she led him to one of the lone cars. Another who had been with me, a black giant of a man, lumbered over to a pickup truck, where an elderly male leaned against the driver door, arms crossed. They shook hands. The larger man opened the passenger door. The truck rocked as he struggled to get in. It was a bus for me. Phoenix? I'd visited a few times on business, but had no real contacts. I knew nothing about Tucson. Maybe I should head out to parts unknown. Really start all over, in every way. With an attempt at dispassion, I decided that the known was better than the unknown. I want some order to this puzzle that is my life. Scene 2. "I'm scared," Jay laughed. "Of what?" She shrugged. "It's such a big house. It's more than a house. It's a mansion." She had whispered the last word. "Did you ever think we would own such a place?" "No, not really." She stepped close to his side and laid her head on his shoulder. "Truly, you are such a planner. All those years, you never dreamed of this house, these cars, the success?" He laughed again. Taking each of her arms, he turned her towards him. "Stella, you know me. I plan, I work hard, I don't dream." She leaned in to give him a quick kiss. "True. And you know I loved the house from the start, but it belonged to someone else and was full of their furniture. Now it's big and empty and ours. A little overwhelming," she smiled, "but I'm excited. You got the key?" He pulled it from his pocket and held it up. She feigned a serious expression. "Are you ready to enter our new home?" "Yes, yes," she shouted, giving a little clap. "Let's." "Okay, since I'm a planner, here's the plan. It's now empty. It's ours. So let's visit each room. And in turn, we tell each other our ideas for decorating. No debate or discussion right now. On and on until we've been through them all." "Even the closets?" "Even the closets." "The wine pantry?" "The wine pantry." "Then what?" "Then we take our time, months if need be, to discuss and decide. This house is the result of many years of hard work and integrity. It should be decorated with care and order." She shook her head. "I'm not sure I can be patient. But I'll try." "Good. Everything always works out as it should anyway, right?" "Indeed it does, my dear Jay. We are living proof." She looked at the door. "Let's do it." Jay laughed at her playfulness. It had been a great year, a great 10 years. He turned the key in the lock of the large wood and wrought iron door and threw it open with a flourish. Scene 3. As I waited for the bus to leave, I thought about the tasks ahead. It was a puzzle, I decided. A puzzle with missing pieces, pieces that don't belong, and no picture of what the completed puzzle should look like. Someone created the game by tossing random pieces into an empty box. I have enough money for food, travel, and lodging for a little while. I need to speak with Mr. Monroe. He might have some good ideas or contacts for me, maybe even some work for a time. But every time I tried to call, he was out of the office or with a client. The last time I had spoken with him was over a month ago. I had been ordered over to the central office to take his call, a call I had not expected. As I walked over, wondering what it was about, I had a panic attack. It was too much like my last visit to the central office 9 years earlier. Yet when I'd gotten there, it was good news, and he seemed genuinely happy. Since then, I had tried to call 3 times. The last time, a week ago, had not gone well. Sitting in the bus seat, waiting, I replayed the call in my mind. The office assistant asked me if I wanted him to call me back, and I had to remind her again that I could not receive calls. She got testy, and I hung up. As I stood there holding my little notebook, a man nearby, John something, asked if I was done with the phone. I told him yes and got up, but he said he had heard I was leaving and wanted to know if I had plans. I had said, not really. It wasn't his business. You should look up my old boss, he had said. He's always willing to give a guy a chance. Take me on every time I need work. Runs a commercial fishing operation out of San Pedro. I told him I had no experience, but he said it didn't matter. Despite my insistence that I wasn't interested, he grabbed my notebook and pencil and wrote the name and address. I remember being offended. It wasn't proper to touch other men's personal property in there. Thinking back on that conversation made me snort. If I ended up on a fishing boat, it would mean that the puzzle pieces are useless cardboard. Scene 4. If you can donate another 5 or more before December, I could get this taken care of. The sooner the better. It can be any charity. I'm happy to donate more, Jocelyn, but I've given a good amount already. What's the goal? She spread her hands out. True, you have donated far more than most clients, but 5,000 more and I can get a significant tax advantage for you. It's just an accounting and tax law issue. He smiled. Anthony recommended you as the best tax accountant, and that's why I asked for you. But here's the thing. Jay leaned forward. The fine leather squeaked. I will happily donate more, but not for a tax break. Jocelyn thought, oh no, another self-righteous, bleeding heart with too much money. You keep working on my finances. In the next month, an opportunity might present itself. If it is a real need that I can meet and it's the right thing to do, I'll do it. It might be more than 5,000, it might be less. If that happens, I'll let you know. If not, that's the way things work out, as they should. Yep, she thought, another fabulously successful man salving his conscience by pretending to have integrity with his opulent wealth. She spread her manicured fingers before her on the desk, bright red nails. I understand, but it's just numbers. Give another 5 or 10 to some organization you've already donated to. They'll be happy. You get the tax break. It doesn't matter. Ah, but it does matter. It is not just money. It is action in life. Everything works together. Everything has an effect. I will not donate for a tax break. It may not make sense to you, but it does to me. He smiled. She nodded. Of course, Mr. Adam, I am here to serve you. And now that you've made a show of integrity, you'll do as I ask with a clean conscience. I've seen it 1,000 times. I can wait. Good. And stop calling me Mr. Adam. I'm Jay. Yes. Okay, Jay. Thank you. He shook her hand and left the office. As she began to shift through the papers in her desk, a knock came at the door. Come. A head appeared around the jamb. Close-cropped hair. Tanned skin. How'd it go? She nodded. Good, good. He stepped in and adjusted his tie. But he gave me the old, no, I don't want to give to charity just to get a tax break speech. But how he described it was strange. He laughed. That's Jay Adam. And it was not a speech. He lives it. He'll hemorrhage money rather than go against his beliefs, even when it would be ethical and moral and legal. But you won't find a more successful businessman, or a better man. A few hours later, a vase of flowers and an envelope were delivered to her office. The envelope contained a generous gift certificate to the Goldenrod Club. She flipped the card over. Jocelyn, you are the best. You and Ephraim enjoy this dinner on us. Signed, Jay and Stella. Scene 5. The bus bounced and banged along the freeway. The 8 passengers were dispersed like shy children on the first day of school. Periodically, an alarming bang shook the bus. I hadn't been on a bus for over 10 years, but I remembered that it was a social convention to ignore both the noises and the other passengers. I stared out the window at a world that was familiar in some ways, but foreign in others. Sand, dirt, and scrub brushes spread out on either side of the freeway. A dirt access lane raced along behind a short fence. A perpendicular road appeared and flashed by. Arrow straight, it cut through the brown-yellow land as if cut with a laser until it reached a vanishing point. The dust and dirt on it belied its lack of traffic. Ahead, a collection of buildings caught my eye. As we drew close, I saw it was a tiny community, about 10 clapboard houses and a few rusted mobile homes. Old cars were parked nearby. Some were heaps of rust, with missing tires and hoods raised. There was no activity. Was it abandoned, like the road? As we passed, I spotted three small figures running around in a dirt backyard. I guess it was inhabited, despite its condition. It wasn't a town or even a village. It wasn't a temporary camp for road or railroad workers. It had been there a long time. Did it have a name? Were the people outcasts? Maybe they just preferred a small one-horse community to gleaming skyscrapers or manicured housing tracts. A few miles down the road was another. This was even smaller, just three or four obviously abandoned structures. The desert scrub had obliterated any sign of yards, roads, or landscaping. Smashed windows and open doors gazed like dead eye sockets, passing judgment on speeding vehicles. Graffiti covered every external wall. The last building had a caved roof. Who had lived or worked there last? I wondered how long it took for natural creation to reclaim the human-made. A column of black smoke caught my attention ahead. I thought it was on the freeway, but as we approached, I could see it was off to the side near two small buildings. Soon, I spotted small flames around the back of the thick column that billowed straight up into the sky. A bonfire. It was strange to think that out here, far away from population centers or even farmland, people lived, worked, loved, hated, and died. As we drew closer, I saw a figure, outlined by the fire, standing with hands on hips. Unmoving, the person appeared as if toasted black. How could one stand so close without cowering? I craned my neck to watch the watcher as we passed. Just before the window frame blocked my view, the figure appeared to drop its arms and walk straight into the fire. Scene 6. Jay woke and tried to remain still so he wouldn't wake the kids. The television was still on, but the game was long over. He wondered who had won. Karen and Allie were sprawled all over him as he lay on the couch. Both were fast asleep in that free unconsciousness that only children experience. He heard footsteps in the hall. Stella was home. She entered the room and said, "Jay," before clapping her hand over her mouth as she spotted the children. "Sorry," she whispered, admiring the scene. Jay smiled. He loved the joy she found in their family. She pulled her purse from her arm and set it on the ottoman and then sat next to it. "How'd it go?" he asked. She nodded. "Good, good." He knew that tone. Not convincing, love. "No, it was good. The committee is doing some good work." She scrunched up her face. "Jenny made a strange comment." "Yeah?" "We were standing with Kathy, and Kathy asked about the work we're having done. The addition, the arboretum, the stone oven, everything. Jenny said, 'Some people get it all. I need to hang around you more so some of that good luck will rub off.'" Jay waited. "I've always thought that the good stuff we have, the things that happen to us, is because we work hard and try to be decent people." "Well, that's true. We do." "I know we do. But is that why we're successful?" She paused again. "Are we a lucky accident?" Jay began to laugh, but caught himself. "Most definitely not. We plan like crazy people." Karen shifted at Jay's side. She gave a little 3-year-old sigh and went still. Her long eyelashes remained closed. "So you don't think it's all random? Right place at the right time?" "Maybe there's some luck. But those who plan are prepared to take advantage of the chances that come their way. Good work ethic, responsibility, accountability. That's a formula for success and a good life." "But don't you think that sounds kind of trite sometimes? Why did I get appointed to this committee? Why were you asked to join the board of directors of Allied last year? We didn't earn those things." "Sometimes things come because a person is already successful. It's a proof of worthiness based on past efforts." "So where did it start? What was the first success that led to another? And why the first success? Merit? And what about lazy and mean people who succeed? He grinned. Wow, slow down. I always knew you were smart, but it's a little late for discussing the philosophy of existence. His levity failed to have an effect. He reached out his hand. She looked up and took it in hers. Where's this coming from, Stella? She shook her head like a horse shooing away flies. I don't know. Her comment just made me wonder. It's not that complicated, Stella. We work hard. Be decent. Perhaps some luck. Bad people do prosper sometimes, but not for long. Everything works out as it should. She sat, staring at the floor as if in a trance. He wondered if she would say that his words sounded trite again. With a thin smile, she came back to the present. Leaning over, she kissed his forehead. I'm fine. Silly thoughts. She nodded at the kids. We need to get them in bed. Yeah, and us too. He sat up with care and reached for Allie. Stella stood and picked up Karen. Let's get some sleep, said Jay. Everything's fine. You'll see. Stella sighed and then smiled. I'm sure you're right. You always are. Scene 7. A bang and a bounce woke me. Again. I peered out the window. No change. Desert. Dirt. Sand and scrub brushes. Electric poles. The occasional structure dotting the forsaken land. Had I slept 10 minutes or an hour? It looked no different outside. It was bright and sunny, though. The sky was so blue it almost hurt. No clouds. I took that as a positive sign from the universe. I should feel some joy. I had inhabited a foreign world for almost a decade, a world where everything was the same. There was order, but it was meaningless order, punctuated once or twice a month by moments of chaos. At one time, I would have been thrilled with the opportunity for a new start, a clean slate to draw upon, to impose my will through careful choices. I thought I could draw anything I wanted on that slate. I had always figured I was in control. The bus hurtled down the arrow straight road. Trucks and cars flashed by on the other side. Was this Tuesday? Yes. I had the absurd idea to just stay on the bus, go all the way to the end of the line, buy another ticket and ride back to Phoenix. Repeat. I could be the Sisyphus of Greyhounds. I don't suppose the bus line would allow that. Besides, I have a lot of choices in front of me, though not unlimited. I can't bring back the dead or undo the acts of others. But there must be a lot I could do. I had done it before. I just needed to keep working on the puzzle. Which reminded me that I needed to call to find out how many more insurance payments are left. They took most of it, of course. Scene 8. The phone beeped. Yes? Mr. Adam, Mr. Zone is here to see you. Send him in. Jay turned back to the report he was reading. Excellent news. It meant more capital for next year, among other things. He could expand. A motion at the door was Edward Zone hovering outside, as if delay would make it easier. Zone, come on in. Everyone called him Zone. It suited him. He looked worse than usual, disheveled. His bad haircut was especially bad today. Hey, boss, can I talk to you? Of course, have a seat. Jay knew why he was here. Zone shuffled to the chair in front of the desk and sat. He leaned forward as if he might need to jump up and run away at a moment's notice. His unfocused gray-blue eyes looked at the floor, to the surface of the desk, and then back to the floor. Jay noticed that the two lines which ran from either side of his nose to the sides of his mouth were deeper than usual. There was a cranberry-colored scrape on his temple. Well, boss, he glanced at Jay and then back down. I screwed up again last night. He grimaced and let out a sigh of disheartenment. Jay knew he could relieve his anguish, but he thought it better to wait a bit. Let him unearth his failure. Zone was a good guy, but he never seemed to learn from experience. On some days, Jay thought he might gain that skill. On other days, he was sure he never would. Jay also knew that Zone hated to disappoint him, though not enough to stop him from repeating his mistakes, every couple of months, on schedule. I screwed up, he repeated. I wasn't going to do anything, but a friend came into town, and we went out just to get a couple drinks. That's all. He dropped his head. I screwed up again. Enough. Zone, I already talked to the chief. The officer called me last night when he took you in. Who do you think bailed you out? He nodded and grew sadder. That's a good sign, Jay thought. We'll get it straightened out, Zone. But you need to learn where your boundaries are. They'd had this discussion before. I know, boss. I know. I will. Good. You can't keep this up. I might not be able to help you someday. Now, going back to work. We'll talk later. Zone stood and put his hands in his pockets. His height amplified his discomfort and awkwardness. You're a good boss. Thanks, Zone. Happy to help. The phone rang. Zone bobbed his head and ducked out. It was Stella. She had just come from a luncheon at City Hall for one of her civics projects, a reading program for children of single parents, he remembered. She was involved in so many projects, it was hard for him to keep track. He asked how it went. The luncheon went well. We gave awards to the Petersons, who donated so many books last year, and then the mayor talked about the fundraiser and the new opportunities. He was quite happy with the project. That's excellent. Not surprising, of course, but congratulations. Thank you, love. But that's not why I called. I have some exciting news. The mayor told me that he wants you to run for city council. He says you'd be a shoo-in. He's already talked to the other board members, the chief of police, the... That's quite kind and intriguing. Work is awful busy, though. It did make him feel good that the mayor thought he could contribute. I know, Jay. He said you'd say that. He said that it wouldn't require a lot of your time. They'd even make exceptions for meeting attendance. They want your wisdom. That's the word he used. Jay smiled. It's quite a compliment. I suppose I'll have to consider it. I'd like to help, but it's politics. I hate self-promotion. Well, he also said you'd say that, too, and that's exactly why they need you. You'd put the city first. He mentioned when you paid to have that playground built and that charity you set up after the earthquake, he wants you to call him to discuss. Jay was silent. It would be nice to do more than merely contribute money for the common good. Jay? Sorry, I was thinking. I'll give it some thought. Of course, Stella said. Jay was pretty sure that she already knew he would accept. Scene 9. Kinder words have not been spoken. I opened my eyes. The speaker was a man sitting on the bench seat across the aisle. He had not been there before. Facing sideways, his legs and feet were in the aisle. His head looked like a boiled egg, shaved head and face, even his eyebrows. He did have kind blue eyes, but sported a ridiculous grin. I was pretty sure he'd boarded the bus when I had, which meant he'd been in the white van with me, too. I didn't remember. I had no desire for conversation, not from someone on a bus. What? It came out like a croak from my dry throat. He made an O shape with his mouth and flipped both hands up as if feigning surprise. I'm so sorry, you were sleeping. I thought you were just looking out the window. He waited if he expected me to say, oh, that's okay. Oh, that's okay. It was out of my mouth before I knew it. My discipline was weak. I was a bit groggy. He smiled, a big, missing teeth, happy smile. I said, kinder words have not been spoken, don't you think? I don't know what you're talking about. On the radio, the news report. I became aware that music was playing, tinny, crackly music. The driver must have turned on the radio while I was asleep. I didn't recognize the song. Male Singer, some pop electric song, perhaps from the 80s? Howard Jones, maybe? Some break the rules and live to count the cost, he sang. I took a deep breath and shook off the cobwebs of bus sleep. That's a song, not news. Yeah, good music. Before the music, they were talking about assisted suicide. Somewhere made it legal. I don't know where. Never heard of the place. They passed a law, said it was legal. A doctor said when a person is ready to die, it should be their choice. Why should someone tell them their story's not over? Kind of words have not been spoken, don't you think? The music went on. No one ever is to blame. I wanted to tell him to get lost, but I had no idea how long we'd be on this bus together. Even on a bus, there should be some social rules. Yeah, I suppose. If someone wants to die, let them die. I'd never really thought about it. I'd prefer a law that made it illegal to kill people who did not want to die. You can see the summit, but you can't reach it. It's the last piece of the puzzle. I've thought of dying, he continued. I have a bank account, been racking up interest. I could use it, travel to that place, find a doc and do it. I think my story's over. I don't have any more. Didn't you just get out? Sure, he shrugged. But there's no more story to write. He nodded enthusiastically, inviting me to join along. Don't you agree? He grinned even bigger. No one grins like that if there's a sound mind behind it. Why did he choose me out of all the men on the bus? I had no need for chit-chat or necro-philosophy. How do I know, you ask? Still grinning. I shook my head. I didn't ask. How do I know my story is over? Because I am the author. His grin morphed into a triumphant cackle. The author knows. He held up one finger. Some say that stories take on a life of their own once they exist. The author is a fallacy. The story an artifact. He pulled himself up. I disagree. A mental case, educated in literary theory. Good for me. He frowned and looked down at his feet. His mouth opened, then closed. His eyes bulged. He seemed to be struggling. I sat up straight. I had experienced too many instances of the violent that could erupt from the most seemingly gentle of men by the most innocuous trigger. Volatile, the officers called them, who then pepper-sprayed and zip-tied their arms as the body writhed on the ground, screaming. He raised his gaze. His eyes did not show crazy. Intensity, but not insanity. I don't think it's correct, is it? I shrugged. Maybe not. I don't know. I hope this ends soon. Another song was playing now. I knew this one. Older. The Beatles? No, McCartney solo, I think. Didn't he have a band with his wife? Venus and Mercury was the name of the song. The man stared at his feet. He seemed quite sad now. I felt a bit sorry for him, trapped in a mind that stutters and coughs like an old engine. You know, it is your story. You can write it however you like. He looked up at me with an expression of confusion. My story? Yeah, your story. You can write it how you like. He frowned and his face reddened. Oh, I'm not a writer. I write some letters, not very often. Great. I meant the story of your life, how you live your life. Oh, he grinned. I have plans. I have a bank account. Been racking up interest. I could use it. Travel to New York, I think. Maybe Europe. I nodded. Sounds like a good plan. Despite myself, I felt sorry for him. Were his mental problems from drug use or genetics? Still, I was sure he could have made better choices, and still could. There are always options. Yeah, I've heard they have assisted suicide there. I'm going to find the radio doctor, and mercifully, the driver interrupted over a loudspeaker. We're approaching our first stop, Desert Center, in about 20 minutes. A 45-minute stop if you want to get a bite to eat or stretch your legs. You getting off at Desert Center, he asked. Maybe. Not if you are. I have to get to El Centro. That's where my bank is. I have plans for the money. Some radio doctor's going to help me finish the story.